professional football matches are being held every day. No one in the world can calculate how many million people are playing professional football every day. No one in the world can calculate how many billions of people are watching football every day or following football. Just imagine the world without football for a second. What will remain from it? Football is the undeniable reality of the modern world. Football is the soul of our world. Football is the king of the modern world. It's true that big clubs still earn less than major companies and trademarks. For example, PSA is the company that owns Peugeot and Citroën. It earned over 2.1 billion euros in 2016, while Paris Saint-Germain, the most famous French club, earned only 460 million euros in the same year. It is true that in some countries in the world, football isn't the first choice for entertainment. In some of them, it isn't even the first popular sport.
Where's the World Cup being held?
I'm not a soccer fan.
You're not a soccer fan?
I'm not a soccer fan.
Who do you think will win the World Cup?
I don't know.
Will you be watching the World Cup?
Oh yeah, of course.
Who will you be supporting?
Spain,
Real Madrid.
Real Madrid?
Yep.
What do you think Real Madrid's chances are in winning the World Cup?
Big time. I think they'll win. I think they'll take it.
Really?
What do you mean, Real Madrid?
People in the U.S. follow baseball more than football. Canadians follow ice hockey, and Indians follow cricket more seriously than football. And it's true that football isn't made to resolve problems like war, poverty, drought, or disease. But football is the widespread and influential human phenomenon today. To understand this, you only need to take a look at the World Cup. July 13th, 2014, the World Cup final game in Brazil between Argentina and Germany. For the first time, the final match was viewed live by 1 billion people. It means one out of every 7 people was looking at the Maracanã Stadium. This is the power of football. Wars, inventions, scientific awards, natural disasters. Nothing can keep people on the edge as much as a football match in the World Cup. Football is powerful. But what's behind the power? This is one of the answers: money. 2010, this session in Zurich, the FIFA headquarters.
2018, FIFA World Cup.
Sepp Blatter took the podium and read out the names of the next two World Cup hosts.
Ladies and gentlemen, will be organized in Russia.
Russia was picked as the host for the 2018 World Cup and Qatar as a 2022 World Cup host.
Qatar!
There was a wave of joy among the politicians of the cold country as well as the politicians of the tiny warm country and even among the people who jumped up and down out of joy thousands of miles away.
I'm still so proud of Qatar that it's going to be hosting the World Cup, and it's a great deal for us as Arabs.
We are preparing ourselves for everything, and we are welcoming everybody in winter or summer times. We are ready for everything.
The Qataris were happier. Their months-long dogged campaign to become the host had finally paid off.
Thank you for giving Qatar a chance, and we will not let you down. You will be proud of us. You will be proud of the Middle East, and I promise you this.
Qatar has spent billions of dollars to get all eyes fixated on the country for a month. But this isn't the whole story. The World Cup is one of the most money-making events in the world. This is a principle. The economic figures of a country that hosts the World Cup Games widely differ before and after the Games. In 2009, when Brazil was chosen to host the World Cup Games, its economic growth skyrocketed from 0.2% to over 7%. The 2014 World Cup host gained over $63 billion. It is almost equal to the budget of a country like Malaysia. This is the hidden side of the World Cup. When a country hosts the World Cup, everything changes there. The host has to construct stadiums, residential centers, roads, railways, airports, training grounds, entertainment and commercial centers, and many other things. While the games are being held, around 1 million tourists enter the country, and it means more money. It means flourishing tourism, services, and transportation sectors. For example, during the 4 years leading up to the World Cup, 3 million jobs were created in Brazil annually, unemployment rate decreased 4%, and it all means a giant economic leap. Besides that, it gives the host a big opportunity. It has 4 years and a month to advertise and introduce the investment and tourism potentials in its country. Like I said, nothing like the World Cup Games can draw the attention of human beings. 3 years before the 2010 World Cup, the number of tourists who visited South Africa was about 9 million people. 3 years after the World Cup, the number surged to 15 million people. As simple as that. But the World Cup doesn't only affect the host country's economy. It's the biggest event in the world. How can an event that gets every seventh person involved not have an impact on the economy of the travel agencies that take the travelers to the host country, all the companies who advertise their products here and there in the host country, all radio, television, or internet channels that make money through broadcasting the event live or rebroadcasting the matches, all the print media whose sales increase several fold during the event, all football clubs, players, and brokers whose future transfer is decided during the World Cup, all the players who can win bigger sponsors by shining in the World Cup, betting agencies all across the world, public places that broadcast football matches in many countries, the companies that make various products for the fans, these are just the visible parts of the story. For example, think about the number of messages exchanged by the fans during the matches. Watching a final match between a Latin American country and a European country increases internet usage in an African country and puts more money in the operator's pockets. Or imagine the countries that are en route the host country and the tourists visit those countries and enjoy the service of those countries. Or we can even think about the World Cup themed video games or the music tracks composed in different countries about it. It's true, the World Cup shakes the economy of the whole world. Well, we can't expect an ordinary football fan to pay attention to all of these things or even care about these things. People watch World Cup matches to watch football. A beautiful and pleasant collection of victories and losses. The question that how much the World Cup affects the world economy has to be answered by economists. But it might be interesting for you to know how the expenses for the biggest and most exciting show in the world are paid. In the World Cup hosted by Brazil, FIFA earned $4.8 billion. If FIFA makes deals with all the predicted sponsors, and if it grants the right to broadcast this round of the competitions at the highest possible price, the revenues will reach over $5.5 billion in Russia. A part of the money will be awarded to the participating teams, and a part of it will be spent to hold the games. Actually, almost all of FIFA's budget is earned through holding the World Cup. That's why FIFA is always concerned about holding the games flawlessly. That's why it keeps the hosts under constant pressure to always improve the conditions to hold the games. Some countries even go beyond that. They believe FIFA wanted Italy and the US to be at the World Cup. Italy's absence reduced at least $200 million from FIFA's revenues. In case the US doesn't participate in the games, many US companies will be reluctant to advertise during the games.
But I can tell you that the way advertising normally works, TV networks guarantee an audience, and when they fall short of that audience, they have to give away free commercial time.
Yes.
If you're a TV network and your ratings go down, you generally take a financial hit. So if the U.S. team not being in the World Cup affects the ratings, then I think Fox is going to see some effect to their bottom line.
The World Cup is FIFA's most important trade. Many decisions on the World Cup are taken considering this fact, but the story hasn't always been like that. Until the mid-1970s, the World Cup was different. Games were held with 16 teams because FIFA's income wasn't sufficient to invite more teams. The money generated through the participation of enthusiastic spectators would only cover the expenses for the team's trip and accommodations. FIFA would bend over backwards to cut its expenses in order to hold the World Cup and to protect football's credit at the highest possible level. But the 1974 World Cup was a quantum leap. A move towards becoming rich. 4 years later, for the first time in history, U.S. companies had agreed to pay money in return for the license to broadcast the Mexico City Games. Matches at around noon, so the audience in the eastern part of the world could easily watch the games on TV. But the 1974 World Cup in West Germany changed everything. When the legendary Beckenbauer held the second World Cup high up after the historical final, a new era emerged. João Havelange, FIFA's powerful president, had gotten to know with Horst Dassler, the owner of the Adidas company. The two started an ambitious collaboration. Havelange wanted to hold the World Cup with 24 teams, and Dassler wanted to become the most famous name in the world of sports.
Adidas.
After a while, it happened. Finally, in the 1982 World Cup in Spain, the sponsorship by Adidas and Coca-Cola paid off. The first World Cup with 24 teams.
24 nations had gathered to compete for football's ultimate crown.
In the inauguration ceremony, a teenage boy was wearing an Adidas outfit and released a pigeon of peace from inside an Adidas ball. Now the World Cup was becoming a business. Later on, in the 1990 World Cup, everything was bearing Adidas logos. The advertisements, outfits, footballs, shoes, and even referees' jerseys. The crazy growth of the fee to grant licenses to broadcast the games multiplied FIFA's income from the games in the late 1990s. Now more people had television sets, and it had certain meaning. The World Cup had become a more valuable brand for trade. The license to broadcast the games in the 2006 World Cup in Germany exceeded $2 billion, and over 15 major companies in the world sponsored the games. Each of the companies had hired big players for advertisements. In the next World Cup, amid the boisterous noises of the vuvuzelas, FIFA earned $1 billion, the host pocketed $3.5 billion, and Adidas profited $1.5 billion. And this story still continues. The World Cup wasn't the austere 1930 tournament any longer. If Uruguay hadn't constructed the Estadio Centenario that year that housed 90,000 people, and hadn't earned that amount of money by selling tickets, there was no way the expenses for holding the World Cup with 16 teams would be covered. Now, the World Cup has become an industry with billions of dollars of income. It boosted South Africa's tourism by 25%, bolstered Brazil's economic growth by 7%, and now Russian politicians view it as an opportunity to get out of economic recession.
To the people of Russia, I tell them, enjoy and celebrate the World Cup. And to the people of the world, I tell them, come to Russia, enjoy Russia, and celebrate the World Cup.
The World Cup changes the color of the world for a few weeks. It reminds us for a few weeks that football is the indisputed king of the modern world. Us, billions of people who live on this planet, immerse ourselves in the World Cup. We get so attracted to the exciting event that we forget many things. We should remember that exactly when we're sitting in front of the TV and watching our favorite players pass the ball, we are a part of a major and complicated economic system. We're part of the billions of the viewers that send the fees to grant licenses for broadcasting the games spiraling. We're part of the billions of people that advertising companies pin their hopes on and sponsor the games. We're part of the whopping revenues FIFA earns and spends in other places. We're part of the staggering growth of the World Cup host. There are thousands of cogs behind the lovely apparatus with its orderly and amazing function that turn only with one thing, money. It has turned football and the World Cup into the most widespread and effective phenomenon in today's world. This time around, we can view it a little deeper. This is called football. Watch it carefully.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked in
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism. This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by famous Iranian Shiite orator and lecturer, Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
اگر کسی بخواد دین خدا رو بفهمه شناخت پیدا کنه با معارف دین
Understanding the religion of Allah is a difficult and long time consuming task. This means that deep recognition of Allah's religion is not an easy task. The late Ayatollah Fazel Lankarani, one of the prominent Shia scholars in the holy city of Qom, used to say, in order to be called an expert in the field of religion and religious studies, you must spend at least 30 years. In other words, understanding different aspects of a religion is an expertise. Maybe this is why many of the religious maraja reach the rank of marja'iyya at their old age. If you want to give doctorate to a marja taqlid or an Islamic religious authority, it will be several degrees, because he has to study various specialized fields of study. This is how the true understanding of a religion is. However, practicing the religion of Allah is a different case.
عمل به دین هم آسانه هم خیلی زود آدم رو میرسونه به مراتبی از قرب.
In contrast to understanding the religion, practicing it is both easy and short. In other words, practicing the religion of Allah is not difficult. Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam stated, through drinking a glass of water you can go to heaven. But how? Imam As-Sadiq continues, when you are nearing the glass of water to your mouth, say Bismillah, and when you drank the first sip, say Alhamdulillah, and repeat saying Alhamdulillah on each sip. Now Imam As-Sadiq states that if somebody drinks water in this way, with saying Bismillah and Alhamdulillah, then he or she will go for sure to heaven. This is how one must practice the religion of Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanallah.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Police sealed off parts of the city centre in Brussels, Belgium on Sunday night, 27th of November, and deployed water cannon to disperse crowds after violence broke out during Belgium's World Cup defeat to Morocco. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Sun has more details. A riot broke out on the streets of Brussels on Sunday night during the World Cup clash between Belgium and Morocco. Police blasted water cannons and fired tear gas as rampaging football fans chucked fireworks, flipped cars, and set fire to scooters. Around 100 riot police were scrambled to the chaos in the capital during the game, which ended with a 2-0 defeat for Belgium in Qatar. Shocking footage showed fires burning in the middle of the road and raging fans smashing the windows of a red car and driving it through the street before flipping it. In another clip, police could be seen moving in with water cannons as supporters tossed fireworks and pelted cars with bricks. Thick smoke filled the streets as football fans also set off flares and police fired tear gas and raised their shields. Other videos showed Moroccan supporters wearing and waving flags as they ran down the street. Police moved in after one person suffered facial injuries, according to Brussels police spokeswoman Ilse van der Keer. Reports also say some 50 people attacked the Liège-Droxy police station at around 6:10 p.m. in the wake of the match, smashing windows and damaging police vehicles. Shops have also been reportedly destroyed in the violent disturbances. A street lamp also toppled over due to the weight of supporters climbing on it. A bus shelter on Place de l'Isère has also been destroyed. Belgian police detained a dozen people and made one arrest. Brussels Mayor Philippe Claus condemned the violence and warned people not to come to Brussels city centre. He said he had ordered the police to make arrests. "I strongly condemn the incidents that occurred this afternoon," he said. "The police have already acted harshly, so I advise football supporters not to come to the city centre. The police are doing everything they can to maintain public order." Police have reportedly been deployed to the Christmas market in the Belgian capital, Brussels, amid fears of further violence. Disturbances also broke out in the centre of Rotterdam in the Netherlands when around 500 supporters threw fireworks and glass at police officers. Riot police have also been deployed in the streets of Amsterdam after around 500 football supporters let off fireworks and torched a car near the Mercatorplein in the Dutch city. Tensions were already mounting before the start of Sunday's match as fireworks were thrown near Brussels South railway station. It is not clear what sparked the riots in Brussels. Around 7 p.m. calm returned and preventive patrols remain in place in the sectors concerned, police spokesperson Ilse van der Keer said. The rioters used pyrotechnic materials, projectiles, sticks and set fire on the public highway, the police said. Also, a journalist was injured in the face by fireworks. "It is for these reasons that it was decided to proceed with a police intervention, with the deployment of water cannons and the use of tear gas." Morocco's victory was a major upset at the Qatar World Cup and was enthusiastically celebrated by fans with Moroccan immigrant roots in many Belgian cities. Nearly 20% of Belgium's more than 11.5 million people are of foreign origin, with roughly 500,000 people of Moroccan descent. They make up the country's largest non-EU population and one of the largest Moroccan diasporas. The British newspaper The Guardian has more details. Dozens of rioters torched a car, set electric scooters on fire, and threw bricks at cars in Brussels after Belgium's surprise 2-0 defeat to Morocco in the World Cup in Qatar on Sunday night. Police had to seal off parts of the city centre of the capital and deployed water cannon and tear gas to disperse the crowds after violence broke out. One person suffered facial injuries, Brussels police spokesperson Ilse van der Keer said, according to an Associated Press report. The mayor of Brussels, Philippe Clos, urged people to stay away from Brussels city centre, adding that the authorities were doing their utmost to retain order in the streets. Train and tram traffic was also interrupted on police orders during the unrest. There were also disturbances in the city of Antwerp. Police in the Netherlands said violence erupted in the port city of Rotterdam as riot officers attempted to break up a group of 500 football supporters who threw fireworks and glass at police officers. It was not immediately clear how many people were detained by the police during the disturbances. The violence began after Morocco's victory on Sunday afternoon, 27th of November, in Qatar, with second-half goals from Abdelhamid Sabiri and Zakaria Abou-Khalal. The results mean the Belgians are third in Group F, a point behind Croatia and Morocco, with one game left to play.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about some of the laws or religious laws related to business according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, When the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We've been Muhammad Jawad hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about business related Islamic laws with Sheikh Javid. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, in today's world, nobody will be able to work without internet, right?
Yes.
And depending on what IP or internet provider you subscribe to, you need some kind of fast internet. And yes, for these, you have to subscribe to the fast internet companies or ADSLs. Well, or IPs. Well, and the subscription is sometimes expensive. Because of this, people create some kind of interpersonal or, let's say, private networks, right?
Yes.
For themselves. For example, at home or in a kind of private company, which is like a small business. But normally, these big companies of internet don't agree to such conditions so yes, that you could, you know, branch it out to different people, you know. And the question is, well, is it permissible, let's say, to generate or to create such interpersonal networks for yourself, although the big company that you subscribe to does not agree to your doing so?
It is problematic to act in contravention with the written conditions between the two parties. Now,
yes,
if the company, the provider, the internet provider, did not or does not agree,
mm-hmm,
whether implicitly or explicitly, with the user to let his internet be used by other people in an interpersonal network, then it is not permissible for that personal, for that let's say client, to make or to create a private network and allow more users to use the connection. So he himself alone has the right to use it, and no one else can do it, no one else can use it. Okay, if the internet provider does not disagree, and actually it gives its consent to the internet provider to let other people also use it, because of maybe there could be some advantages, or maybe some, it's not going to create a, you know, a problem for the internet provider. So in that case, if they agree, there would be no objection. Otherwise, it's not permissible.
I see. Okay, another question, Sheikh Javid, is that is it permissible to use narcotic drugs such as heroin, opium, crack, cocaine, you know, and the like. Whether there are, you know, the new types or the traditional ones.
You're right.
Because we also have the industrialized type, which is being synthetic, basically, yes. Right? Not so much traditional or as traditional as opium or heroin, for example. And what's the Islamic law or Islamic Sharia concerning the smugglers of these types of narcotics?
Well, since we are talking about halal or haram gains, okay, you know, I would like to just say that according to all religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, may he live long, it is not permissible under any circumstances to sell or to buy or to purchase and distribute drugs which are so, you know, destructive, so dangerous, like heroin and, you know, shisha, or let's say addictive types of drugs which create lasting destructive problems or complications as a result of using those drugs, you know. So I see no you know, religious authorities. I do not know of any religious authorities who may allow the use or the sale of such drugs. All of the religious authorities are agreed on the fact that the sale and purchase and also the distribution of such drugs is absolutely forbidden. Under no circumstance can one sell any of these things or any of those things which you mentioned.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio, with me, Mohammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Our topic is still business-related Islamic laws. Well, Sheikh Javid, you know, sometimes, or oftentimes, I have to correct myself, in today's world, people need other people's assistance for their work.
Sure.
Right?
Yes.
As a kind of proxy. For example, attorneys and barristers, solicitors, lawyers, you know, all of these people use their background knowledge in law, and they come to rescue when you have, for example, a legal action, for example, in a court of law, or if you have a problem with your neighbor or your friend or your company, for example. Is it permissible, basically, in Islam, according to the Sharia laws, to use their assistance, and what about their money?
That's a good question. Well, it is permissible to work as a lawyer or as an attorney, provided that it does not lead to the infringement or the violation of what is right and what is wrong, you know. If, let's say, if an attorney general, let's suppose, you know, finds a client and then he tries to do whatever he can, even by, let's say, deceiving, by making a false claim, tries to defend him while he is, his client is a criminal by nature, or maybe he is a criminal, he has killed someone and he is responsible for the blood of the person, the victim.
Yes.
So if such a thing is there, of course, the money he receives is not halal. He cannot receive any money because he is making false claims, he's lying, and the court and in order to just protect his client. That's not what he should do. So, and generally we see, unfortunately, that attorneys, they, in order to receive their wages from the client, they usually resort to false claims in order to show what is right as wrong and what is wrong as right. So that's not permissible.
I see.
If he tells the truth, if he sticks to the moral standards and to the Sharia law, there's no objection to him. Otherwise, it is a matter of objection.
Sheikh Sawi, let me squeeze in a very short question here till the end. We don't have much time.
Okay.
What's Islamic law about the wages or any money gained or earned illicitly in exchange, for example, for singing, all right? Fornication, dancing, God forbid, any similar prohibitions, all right?
Yes.
Well, what should this person do regarding this money, this wage, or any illicit gain?
Yes. We know that, you know, singing, okay, fornication, and receiving money for prostitution is absolutely forbidden. And, you know, the person who receives that money cannot take possession of that money. He or she cannot own it. So the way the wages received or obtained through forbidden means, generally speaking, should be returned to the owner, to the person who originally owned the money. And the
if
money
they cannot reach that person?
Okay, if the money cannot be, you know, returned to him because he's not available or he is not accessible, then the money should be given to the poor on his behalf if he's Muslim, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise, if he's not Muslim, it cannot be given to the poor on his behalf. It can be given to the poor. It should be given to the poor, okay? But you cannot make niyyah that, okay, this is money going to be used.
So what should they go about the money?
So the money should
be... If that person, the owner, the original owner, is not a Muslim.
Is not a Muslim, okay, the money should be given to the poor. To the poor.
Any
okay.
poor.
Any poor persons, okay? But they should be Muslim, okay? Mm-hmm. Not to someone who is poor, but he's non-Muslim. Maybe he is going to get the money or receive the money and use it again for haram
right.
purposes. So yes, it should be returned to the poor. And that's the answer. Of course, the religious authorities have said that, okay, you give it to the poor, but as radd-i mazalim, okay? Radd-i mazalim, it is a kind of, you know, money owed, you owe, and you give it to the poor people.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid, and thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Rahman Rahim Mannan Kareem Salam Alim La ilaha illa hum Ghaffar Jameel Wahhab Latif Tawwab Sami' Basir La ilaha illa hum وحيد قدير محيي مميت الظاهر والباطن لا إله إلا هو لا إله إلا هو.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.